Psalm 118 is going to be the psalm tonight. And the message is going to be a little different than the previous weeks. And I'm kind of aiming to do two things, and I hope it turns out all right. What I want to do is talk about Psalm 118 in the context of the Old Testament, in the context of the Psalter, but I also want to look at it, how it's understood in the New Testament, in two key places, in the Gospels, in the triumphal entry, and then briefly in an allusion in Ephesians. And I wanted this because the Psalms are used frequently to talk about Jesus. And you can often see certain patterns and ideas that come out of the Psalms. And I thought in our summer series, it'd be a good opportunity to wrestle with that a little bit and see how Jesus comes out in them. And so how I picked this was, a friend of mine is actually going to write his dissertation on this topic, how about Christ is revealed in the Psalms. And so I sent him a message and asked him what he recommended, and I said, well, I already did Psalm 2 at the beginning, and kind of didn't want to do Psalm 22 because I wanted to do something different than Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is the, my God, why have you forsaken me, which Jesus calls out on the cross. But I wanted to go in a different direction, and he then sent me back Psalm 16 and Psalm 118. As kind of ones that I should consider. And so I picked Psalm 118 because it's the psalm that is most often referenced or alluded to in the New Testament. So I thought it'd be a good one to pick. And I wasn't quite sure how things were going to work out. Rachel asked me last week, so what are you thinking about for next week? And I said, I don't know. It's going to be Psalm 118, but I have no idea what to tell you. Normally I have an idea, a trajectory for a few weeks ahead, but this week I wasn't quite sure. And in a really cool way, things came out in the psalm that I hadn't seen before that really excited me. So I'm really excited about this message. And we're kind of going to be bouncing around all over the Old Testament a little bit and then the New Testament. So I hope the overall arc of the message doesn't get lost in jumping around. But I think there's a really cool story that is told with Psalm 118 at the center. When we talk about Jesus in the Old Testament, there is some challenges here. Because when you look at the New Testament, sometimes it looks like they're just kind of proof texting and some obscure quote from somewhere, and they build theology around that. And so sometimes if you read the quote and then you go back to the Old Testament, the Psalms or Isaiah or wherever, and you kind of think, how does that work out? And then, but Psalm 118, I don't think really fits that category. It has an overall story of salvation. It has this kind of plan that's being fulfilled, which really shines through in the New Testament context, in the New Testament story. So we're going to look at Psalm 118 kind of in general terms, and then we're going to jump around a little bit. So Psalm 118 is on page 907 in the Pew Bibles, and as has been the pattern in the past few weeks, I'm going to read from a different translation. Good. And I'm going to be using instead of the Lord, I'm going to be using the Old Testament name Yahweh in my reading of it. Good. Give thanks to Yahweh, for he is good. His hesed endures forever. May Israel say, for his hesed endures forever. May the house of Aaron say, for his hesed endures forever. May the ones who fear Yahweh say, for his hesed endures forever. From distress I call out to Yahweh. Yahweh answered me from the expanses. Yahweh is for me. I will not fear. What can a human do to me? Yahweh is for me, the one who helps me. But I myself will see the ones who hate me. It is better to seek refuge in Yahweh than a human. It is better to seek refuge in Yahweh than princes. All the nations surround me. In the name of Yahweh, indeed, I cut them off. They surround me. Yes, they surround me. In the name of Yahweh, indeed, I cut them off. They surround me like bees. They extinguish like fire the thorn bushes. In the name of Yahweh, indeed, I cut them off. You strongly thrust me to fall, but Yahweh helped me. My strength and my song is Yahweh, and he became my salvation. A voice cries out, indeed, salvation in the tents of the righteousness. The right hand of Yahweh does mighty deeds. The right hand of Yahweh is exalted. The right hand of Yahweh does mighty deeds. I will not die, but I will live, and I will report the works of Yahweh. Yahweh has strongly disciplined me, but he did not give me over to death. Open for me the gates of righteousness. I will enter them. I will give thanks to Yahweh. This is the gate of Yahweh. The righteous will enter them. I will give thanks to you because you answered me and you became my salvation. The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. This will be from Yahweh. This is wonderful in our eyes. This is the day in which Yahweh worked. Let us rejoice and be glad over it. O Yahweh, save us, please. O Yahweh, deliver us, please. Blessed is the one who comes in the name of Yahweh. We bless you from the house of Yahweh. Yahweh alone is God, and he makes light for us. Bind the festal with cords up to the horns of the altar. You alone are my God. I will praise you. My God, I will exalt you. Give thanks to Yahweh, for he is good. His hesed endures forever. In Psalm 118, it comes at the end of a collection of psalms, and this collection would be from Psalm 113 to 118, and this is often called either the Egyptian Hallel or the Passover Hallel, which means praise God. And they're connected by their similarity and a few repetitions of phrases, and they're probably sung during the pilgrimage feasts to the temple. And it stands out at the end of this collection, this Psalm 118, as a thanksgiving psalm. And it could be either understood as a thanksgiving psalm of a person or perhaps of the king. And we see in the story the progression to salvation and the progression then to the temple from the gates to the house of, or from the gates to the temple to the altar. Now verse 1 and 29 are exactly the same. Give thanks to Yahweh, for he is good, for his hesed endures forever. And this brackets the whole song, this call to give thanks, this praise to God, because his unfailing love, his kindness, his covenantal faithful love is with us. And that's the word hesed, which I read out throughout the Psalms. And I mentioned this a few weeks ago, that in Hebrew class, when we learned this word, our teacher just said, just write it out, because you need too many adjectives to describe this kind of word. It has to do with Yahweh's uprightness, his trustworthiness, his justice, his love. It's all kind of bound up in this word. Now, the background of this psalm would probably be after the destruction of the temple and celebrating, looking forward to its restoration. Now, I mention the destruction of the temple and the exile fairly often, and this would have happened in 586. After years of unfaithfulness, after years where the people rebelled against God, didn't listen to the words of his prophets. Finally, God said, I have to punish you. I have to send you out of the land. I must exile you. And then the Babylonian Empire came in 596, which was a little bit before, exiled many of the people. And then they continued to rebel. And then eventually Babylon came and destroyed the temple and exiled another large amount of the people. And this was such a huge thing that happened to the life of the people that it caused them to reflect on who we are, what's going on, what's the situation. And the same Old Testament prophet that I mentioned about Hebrew, he would say that the interpretive key in many situations when you're reading the Old Testament is to think, what would a person in exile be thinking about this text? How would they wrestle with it? Because that became like the overarching kind of thing that they were dealing with, wrestling with it. And we see this in the prophets. You either see the threatening of punishment of exile and then the hope for restoration after it. And that's kind of key. And the books from Samuel, Kings, kind of wrestling with, how did we get here? How did we get into exile becomes a thesis. So it's not an overstatement to say that exile is kind of the background to many of the Old Testament stories as people are wrestling through what's happened, why did God punish us. And I mentioned this kind of looking forward to restoration. And I'd like to just briefly flick to Ezra 3:11. I'm just going to read it quickly. I forgot to write down what page it's on. That would be 679. And I just want to read this verse two verses to highlight how important this phrase is. We have 3:11. And this is after the altar was set up, after the people were allowed to return under the Edict of Cyrus in 539. And they go back and they immediately set up the altar so they can start sacrificing to God again. And this is a key point, and this brings out a lot of praise. And so in verse 11, with praise and thanks, they sang this song to the Lord. He is good. His faithful love for Israel endures forever. And this is the same line, for his hesed endures forever. And this becomes kind of a key verse. The verse 12 continues here. Then all the people gave great shout, praising the Lord, because the foundation of the Lord's temple had been laid. So this is picked up in the similar phrase, a similar idea in this post-destruction, this restoration time when they'd returned to the land and they were starting to try to reconnect with Yahweh to start things over. And this phrase is repeated in the response of him in Psalm 136. It's repeated after every phrase, for his hesed endures forever. In Psalm 118, going back there, verses 2 to 4 is the introduction where it's calling everyone to praise the house of Israel, the house of Aaron, which would then be the priests, and then to everyone who fears Yahweh, everyone who desires a relationship with him. Verses 5 to 18 declare a situation of distress, but then God acting within that situation, being in danger, being hard-pressed, but Yahweh delivering the psalmist, being his help and his deliverance. We see in verse 18 perhaps this exile background with Yahweh severely disciplined me, but he did not give me over to death. He punished us for our sins, but he didn't abandon us. He still had a plan of salvation. He had a plan to bring us back and return things to order. Verse 14, Yahweh has become his salvation. And then we look at verses 19 and to 28, this next section. It's this progression to the temple, from the gates to the temple to the altar. It's kind of from being outside, moving in to that place, the place where Yahweh's presence would have dwelt. And the psalmist recounts this progression, this movement, this development. So Psalm 118, that's a really quick overview. A lot could be said about Psalm 118, but as the center point of the message, I want to frame it around the idea of Yahweh coming to save. And there's connection points with other texts, both earlier in the Old Testament and then in the New Testament. And I'd just like to touch on, though, to say how this kind of progression of Yahweh's salvation, of his desire to save, is recounted. And the first one is Exodus 15, and this is the Song of the Sea. This is the song that was sung after Yahweh had delivered his people from Egypt. They had been there in slavery for 400 years, and then Yahweh sent Moses to deliver his people and bring them out. And after this great act of deliverance, they sing this psalm. And in Exodus 15:2, you have the exact same verse as in Psalm 118:14, and with a little bit similar in verse 21. And that is, Yahweh is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. And it's quoted identically. So there must be a literary connectedness where the psalmist is connecting his psalm, his story, to this Exodus story, this hope for a new Exodus coming about, a new situation of restoration where God's mighty hand is fully revealed. There's several other points of connection, not just this one, but this is by far the strongest one. I mentioned the right hand. It occurs both in Exodus 15 and in this passage. And there's also an emphasis on the uniqueness of God, this one act of God in becoming his people. This is echoed in both Psalms. And this focuses on the God who shows up, who doesn't leave his people in Egypt. He doesn't leave them there, but he fulfills his promises that he made to the forefathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob, the promise that he would return them to the land. And he does this, and the psalmist is picking up on this theme, hoping that God will again do that thing, celebrating that God is the God who saves, that saved his people in the past, and is trusting in this situation that God is going to save again, that he'll bring a complete restoration about. Like in the Exodus, in a small way, is like Henderson's goal in the Summit Series, or perhaps you would say Crosby's goal in 2010 Olympics. When we mention that, there's invokes for many people this sort of Canadian spirit feeling that you kind of get. When we mention the Exodus, it's so much bigger, but we're just a brief mention of it, a brief connection. It fills these ideas of hope, of saving, of God's mighty hand and his outstretched arm for his people. And that's why the psalmist alludes to it here. Another connection is to Isaiah, and this is the same verse in Exodus 15:2, We have in Isaiah 12:2, both alluding to Psalm 18:21. And Exodus 12 is a key song that comes at the end of this passage of judgment and movement to hope, with Isaiah 11 being the prophecy of the branch coming out, this son of David who will then restore order, set things to rights, makes things good again. And then Isaiah 12 then celebrates this action, celebrates that God will again redeem his people. He'll bring them out of the exile and restore their fortunes again. So to summarize, I'll let, as I've done a few of the past weeks, like Eric Zenger in this commentary summarize it, because he does it so well. The scene in the body of the psalm presents the entry of someone saved by Yahweh into the temple as the place of righteousness and the divine presence that is experienced and celebrated in the festival. Poetically, this is imagined in such a way that this event is tied into the history of Yahweh with his people, and indeed with the whole world of the nations, and placed within a time horizon extending from Israel's beginning to the completion of its history. This powerful spatial and temporal horizon in the psalm is constituted primarily by the intertextual links to the book of Exodus, the past, and the book of Isaiah, the future. So the psalmist is drawing on all these themes and ideas and these anticipations, this excitement as he composes this psalm, as he celebrates Yahweh's deliverance, as he calls out in verse 25, "For Yahweh to save us, please, deliver us, please, you alone are God." It's this covenantal love that the psalmist is counting on. So flipping over to the New Testament, we see how the psalm is picked up in the Gospels. And it's right as Jesus is about to enter Jerusalem. And I'm going to use Mark as the background to which we discuss this. And I could have used any one of the Gospels, because this Psalm 118 is key to it regardless. And if you want to flip over to Mark, we won't read chapter 11, but we'll read chapter 12. It's on page 1539 in your pew Bibles. And we see this is the week before his crucifixion, where he's crucified on the Friday, arrested on the Thursday. And this is as he comes, and the people then celebrate his arrival by quoting Psalm 118, verses 25 and 26. And then it continues on in the week, and it doesn't take too long for the people to not be excited, because at the beginning of the week, they were celebrating him as king, the arrival of the seemingly long-awaited Messiah, celebrating his arrival, declaring, "Yes, blessed is the one who comes in the name of Yahweh." But it doesn't take too long for them to get upset at him, and then the week concludes, or I guess the week doesn't conclude. The week moves up to a little bit later where he's crucified. But before that, he quotes Psalm 118:22 in an oracle against the priests and the teachers of the law where he describes them as the wicked tenants, the one who hasn't taken care of God's creation, of God's people, fulfilled their responsibility. He quotes a tad earlier in the psalm, "The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone." Now, I chose Mark's gospel because there's a strong new Exodus motif where throughout the gospel of Mark, there's these themes that connect it to the Exodus. And I'll read a quote from Ricky Watts from Regent College in Vancouver. And he wrote I don't know if it's his dissertation or not, but he's written the kind of the definitive work on the allusions to the Exodus in Mark's Gospel. I'm going to read this out of the commentary of the New Testament use of the Old Testament. And I'm just going to quote here. "As we noted, or as early in this commentary, Jesus' exorcism, especially his drowning of the demonic legion in the sea in Mark 5, 1-20, forgiveness of sins, healing of the lame, deaf, mute, and blind, feeding of the crowds, and control over the sea, testify to the victorious inauguration of Isaiah's new Exodus, exactly the kind of wonders and merciful acts for which, in the rabbinic tradition of Psalm 118, the nation could only give thanks as do the joyous pilgrims. Hosanna is as much a thankful salutation as a plea." So Mark's been drawing these kind of new Exodus themes, and he alludes to Psalm 118, or as the crowds are there. And what's interesting about this is that Yahweh is replaced in the other Gospels as well with terms of king instead of king, son of David, king of Israel. And it's not Yahweh here. It's been changed, which shows that the people understood this psalm to be referring to the return of the king, to Lord of the Rings. So that Yahweh would then again dwell among his people and would redeem his people through his agent, his king. And this is almost used somewhat ironically as the people celebrate Yahweh's return to the temple, as they celebrate this king here, because the people are frustrated almost immediately afterwards. They don't really celebrate that Jesus has arrived, that the Messiah is there, and then they turn on him. And this what goes to the other quote after from Psalm 118, 22. To summarize the use here at the beginning, I'm going to read Watts again. Christology and refers to the things about Christ and his messiahship and his revealed nature. Eschatology being the last things, and ecclesiology being words about the church and ideas about the church and how the church functions together. So here's a quote. Christology, eschatology, and ecclesiology are again intertwined. Psalm 118 presents Jesus as Israel's Davidic Messiah, in whom Yahweh's authority is uniquely invested, returning victoriously from defeating the nation's oppressors, in this case, the demonic. Eschatologically, this signals the climax of Israel's hope of messianic restoration, and in particular, that of the temple. Ecclesiologically, to reject Jesus is to be an enemy of the Lord's anointed, and therefore equally liable to the wrath of the Lord, who enthroned him as his son. So this idea of rejection leads to the second quote. And this comes at the end of the parable of the wicked tenants. And I just would like to read that in its entirety, which is on page 1541 in your pew Bibles. Then Jesus began teaching them with stories. A man planted a vineyard. He built a wall around it, dug a pit for pressing out the grape juice, and built a lookout tower. Then he leased the vineyard to tenant farmers and moved to another country. At the time of the grape harvest, he sent one of his servants to collect his share of the crop. But the farmers grabbed the servant, beat him, and sent him back empty-handed. The owner then sent another servant, but they insulted him and beat him over the head. The next servant he sent was killed. Others he sent were either beaten or killed, until there was only one, his son, whom he loved dearly. The owner finally sent him, thinking, "Surely they will respect my son." But the tenant farmers said to one another, "Here comes the heir to this estate. Let's kill him and get the estate for ourselves." So they grabbed him and murdered him and threw his body out of the vineyard. "What do you suppose the owner of the vineyard will do?" Jesus asked. "I'll tell you. He will come and kill those farmers and lease the vineyard to another. Didn't you ever read this in the scriptures? The stone the builders rejected has now become the cornerstone. This is the Lord's doing, and it is wonderful to see." The religious leaders wanted to arrest Jesus because they realized he was telling the story against them. They were the wicked farmers, but they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away. But the stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. And is the rejection of Jesus, it is the sending away of Jesus that it eventually brings salvation, that brings about God's plan of salvation. And on the cross, the nations quite literally surround him as the psalmist mentioned in verse 10 and following. But it is through this rejection, it is through this rejection of God's Messiah that eventually brings about salvation. In the context of Mark, it was those who were entrusted with the law and the land and the stewardship of the people that rejected his servant, that eventually forced him to go to the or eventually propelled him to the cross. And in the story, the vineyard owner thinks that if he sends his son, that eventually the son will be respected. But in its exact opposite, they decide to kill him, thinking that they will be able to then maintain control. But it's through this rejection that salvation is brought. And it's Psalm 118 in this background, this Psalm 118 at the beginning of the triumphal entry and in this verse that shows that it's God's plan for salvation all along. This is what God has been working towards in sending his son and sending his people. This drawing the people back to him and working out his plan, working out the restoration of life. And it's through this rejection that that Jesus goes to the cross and through his death and resurrection that brings about God's ultimate plan of salvation, how the scriptures have been building towards this situation where the Messiah would take on the suffering of the people. He would take on the suffering of everyone and bear the sins of the people, which would eventually bring salvation, eventually bring reconciliation with God, eventually deliver them from the situations of distress, situations of fear, situations of anguish. I'd like to look at one final example. That's in Ephesians 2, 20 and 21, and this would be on page 1775 in the Pew Bibles. And this is, it shows that in Jesus' death and resurrection, then in the resurrection becomes the beginning of the church, beginning of the mission to declare what God has done, to declare his plan of salvation to the entire world. And we see how Paul alludes to this idea that Jesus has become the capstone. He's become the center point of the church and the church's identity. And we have this in Ephesians 2, 20 and 21. I'm going to read verses starting with 19 here. So now you Gentiles are no longer strangers and foreigners. You are citizens with all of God's holy people. You're members of God's family. Together we are his house, built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, and the cornerstone is Jesus Christ himself. We are carefully joined together in him, becoming a holy temple for the Lord. Through him, you Gentiles are also being made of this dwelling place where God lives by his Spirit. So in Psalm 118, we have this progression into the temple, into the altar, starting with the gates. And then Paul picks up this theme that now the rejected stone has become the cornerstone, has become the foundation of the new temple people, of the people of God being shaped around him, being shaped as part of his plan of salvation. And it's throughout this, the entire arc of the Old Testament story and picked up in the New Testament, that God's desire to be with his people, to redeem his people, for relationship, for communion, for fellowship together. And it's how, and Psalm 118 is in the message, the center point where we see how it picks up the ideas of the Exodus, it picks up the ideas of future hope, and how it's then picked up in the New Testament as this story of salvation, of God, of Jesus, the God, Jesus coming to the people, the God himself coming down to be with his people, to fulfill this plan of salvation. So give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his love, his hesed endures forever. So we might not have understood exactly all the things that are going on in Psalm 118. But I hope that tonight's message has perhaps shown a picture of the character of God, about how he is willing to come, how he's always seeking relationship, how he's seeking salvation, he's seeking fellowship with his people. Saw that in the Exodus, when he doesn't leave them in Egypt, or in Isaiah, where with the promise of future hope after punishment, and how that's picked up in Ezra as things move to restoration. In the Gospels, it announced that God had arrived, that he was coming to redeem his people. And that how even that through the rejection, that God has redeemed him from the dead, and then begins this process of redeeming his people, of creating new life in us all. He's come to redeem us in whatever our situations are, this plan of salvation that God has been working towards. And also how based upon Jesus' death and resurrection, this new life that's coming out, that he's become the building blocks of his church. And it gives us this mission to continue building on this, being energized through his Spirit as we continue his redemptive work, declaring that he is Lord, that he is making all things new in us, building on the foundation that he did, and praising him for it. Just like in verse 28, saying that you alone are God, and I will praise you. My God, I will exalt you. So as a response, I'd like to give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his hesed endures forever. And perhaps this might be the first time that you've kind of heard about God's saving plan, his saving action, his overall theme of love in your lives. Or perhaps you've heard it many times, but tonight I invite you to think about it either for the first time or anew about how God's overall story is to desire relationship with us and to love us and to meet us where we're at and not leave us there, but to invite us into relationship with him, relationship with his church. And it's the table here that is the center point of our response time. And it's the table that celebrates these two things of God's saving plan, of his desire to be with us, that he didn't leave us, whether it be that he didn't leave his people and he doesn't leave us and where we're at, that he reaches and he comes to save us and redeem us. God desires relationship with us, and he extends so far as to come himself to reach us as he comes to his people saying, I'm here, I want to save you. And for that we can give thanks to him, for he is good, because we know his hesed endures forever.